On Wednesday night, we worked our way through most of chapter 13 and discussed some of the issues that Nehemiah found when he came back into town into Jerusalem. There were four major issues that just kind of stood out when he came back into town. You know, he found that the temple was not in the order that he'd left it in. Eliashib, the one that he had left in charge, had not done what he was supposed to do. In fact, he had Tobiah living in the storerooms, the enemy of all that Nehemiah had tried to do and accomplish. We find that the priests were not being given their portions. They were not being supported, really, in the work that they were to do. In fact, they had gone back to their fields to support their families. And of course, this just kind of, you know, complicated the issues that they were dealing with in Jerusalem, because now the law wasn't being read. There was not the spiritual services going on that should have been taking place. And that's kind of one of those things that's kind of like a snowball going downhill. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger as far as the problem, you know, that they had and what was going on. Well, and then there was the issue of the Sabbath, that they weren't really remembering the Sabbath. The Sabbath was just another market day in Jerusalem. And all that was going on with that. And if we tried to think about just the scene of the Sabbath in Jerusalem and what that was like and how confusing that was. And there was just not reverence being paid to God. And so there was all kinds of problems with that. And then we were talking about, as our time came to a close, the fourth problem. We had talked about it some already. You know, the emotional issue of mixed marriages. And that is that the Jews had married some from the enemy nations around them, those that God had said not to intermarry with. And what was most frustrating, I'm sure, to Nehemiah is that it was not a new issue. Ezra had already dealt with that years before. And Nehemiah had led them to make promises even, a covenant with God that they wouldn't do such a thing. And here just a short time later, they were in the midst of all of that. And as we were talking on Wednesday night when our time came to an end, Nehemiah made some reference here to King Solomon, you know, in this text as they were dealing with this issue. And in chapter 13, let's see, he said, well, in verse 26, was it not because of marriages like these that Solomon, king of Israel, sinned? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was loved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. But even he was led into sin by foreign women. Must we hear now that you too are doing this terrible wickedness and are being unfaithful to our God by marrying foreign women? And so the question is asked, well, why bring Solomon into this? What was the point? I mean, there was a purpose in bringing up Solomon. Why did he mention Solomon? Yeah. I mean, the warning was so real that was given. Do not marry, you know, these. And of course, Solomon knew that too. And yet he did that. And the result of that was just, it was just incredible. In fact, hold your finger here. Put a marker here for a minute. Let's go back to 1 Kings chapter 11 for just a moment. Let's go back in time a little bit. And let's understand why Nehemiah would bring this up. And, you know, I don't think it was like not on the mind of these Jews. Well, they all knew the story of Solomon. I mean, he was one of the greatest kings of all time. And they knew what had kind of gone wrong in his life, so to speak, and where he had done things that he shouldn't do. So we're in 1 Kings, and let's just read a few verses here, beginning the first of the chapter, 1 Kings chapter 11. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and the Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. Just stop there for a minute. You try to absorb what has happened here. The number of wives that he has was just incredible. You know, but they were all foreign wives. That is, they had brought their culture and their gods. That's specifically what the Lord was emphasizing to us here. They had brought their gods, and he had warned them that if you do this, here's what's going to happen. It's exactly what happened, even with Solomon, the wisest man of all. And yet he still was pulled in because of these foreign gods. You would have thought, wouldn't you, that if anyone could have overcome the power of these other gods, Solomon would have been wise enough to do it. But even he couldn't hold out. The influence of his wives and their gods, it worked on him. How much so? Verse 5. And he followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. He didn't forget Jehovah God, not totally. He still knew Jehovah God. But the enemies of God have almost always been that way. They knew of Jehovah God, but they didn't follow him. Now, verse 7. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and from Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had been turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. I'm not sure where you start and stop with what's wrong with this when you talk about Solomon and what he has done here. I mean, it is to the point that in Jerusalem, where, remember, it was Solomon who rebuilt the temple of the Lord? You know, Solomon who built the temple on the hill in Jerusalem built as well shrines to the gods of his wives. And, you know, the ones that are kind of called out here is just amazing to me. Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and Molech, the god of the Ammonites. They offered children to Molech. Remember that? I mean, that's what was happening in Jerusalem now under Solomon's watch. And the root cause of this, God says, was the gods of his foreign wife. And so when we think that somehow we are not going to be pulled in by the influences of those around us, Solomon was. And he was the wisest of all men. Your thoughts, comments?
Well, what struck me is that God appeared to him, and he still, I mean...
Still. Is this amazing or what? You know, I mean, the relationship he had with God and what God had him do, that was good because of that relationship. Only in time to have what was good, he wrote it away.
Our actions and our behaviors as humans are controlled by what or who we love. And if we love Jesus, then that is where our actions and our behaviors come from. If we love, and this is a great example of why not to marry someone who is of another faith.
The influence.
Because, right.
So
the
great.
Influence,
yeah.
Someone who doesn't hold truth is going to influence you to one degree or another. Certainly there are people who can be faithful, and I admire that.
Sure is hard.
It's difficult.
That's right. And even Solomon was taken in. Daryl.
We often are capable of ignoring our own advice. And Solomon wrote the book of Proverbs, which many say is a book about how a young man should go about looking for a woman, the kind of woman that he should marry.
Yeah.
And so he obviously ignored his own writings in that case.
Yeah. It, take his own advice.
That's a problem. His problem is love.
That's right. And it ate him up. Ken.
Why do these foreign gods have the pull that they do?
It's amazing that the foreign gods would have the pull that they did, in particular in view of what was required to worship some of those gods, like offering your children in the belly of Molech, you know, in the fire of Molech, and children being offered alive. It's just beyond what I can even comprehend. And yet that's part of what was required. That's part of what the service to Molech, the god Molech, was. You know, it was those kinds of offerings. And how people can think and rationalize that that was good or that was the right thing to do, Ken, that's just beyond me. You know, I can't get there. You know, but prevalent for hundreds of years, you know, it was.
And the root of that was selfishness. They were desirous of what would make them feel good, what was pleasurable, what would benefit or convenience them. And the same thing going on today. Mm-hmm. They literally took their babies and threw them into the fire. Mm-hmm. We murdered 60 million babies mm-hmm. in the womb since 1973. The only difference is it's being done discreetly behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. But it's just every bit as horrific as what they were doing.
And the God is selfishness. Oh, yeah, good point.
Changing of your heart or adjusting
yeah.
your line. We see that
right.
today. I think
sure.
that's the reason most people reject the Bible is because they mm-hmm. don't want to alter their lives to fit with God's word.
Yeah.
I really believe that's the problem.
Yeah, because realistically, the foreign gods are all around us, just as prevalent today, so to speak. Maybe more so than then. The draw is great. Gene, did you have your hand? Okay. Got it. Okay. Good. Very.
Just a
Gary.
Side note. Just as a side note, says here on the hill east of Jerusalem, during Christ's time, the place east of Jerusalem, the hill Mount of Olives.
That interesting?
Yeah.
You wonder, you know, was it that hill? You know, and I don't know that we would be able to just totally narrow that down. But that is the hill. East of Jerusalem, just the other side of the Kidron Valley. That's where that would be. Emily.
When I was at the theater, I had a class on ancient Near East, and the professor, when we got to the Hebrews, she said, now they were a polytheistic country nation. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I mean, I was like, how could she say that about God's chosen people? But historians and archaeologists study them as polytheists because they found so many of these perverse ashram everywhere. And so they had ruined their influence mm-hmm. among all the nations around them yeah. by adopting these other gods and goddesses and whatever else. And it was pure perversion.
Yeah.
You know, these temple priestesses and things like that. And the reason that they adopted a big part of it was because they had just become so base.
You know, for a people that God wanted and expected to stand out as different from the nations around, they so quickly absorbed the nations around them. Or maybe it's the other way around. Those nations absorbed them because they let themselves go there. I mean, the people of God were supposed to be the ones who just stood out, just like today. I mean, we should be distinguished from the world. And there were times with Israel that they were. When they were obeying God and following God, and God blessed them, they were a powerful nation. Indeed, they were distinguished from the world. They looked different. And that's really what God was trying to introduce back in Jerusalem. When Nehemiah came back, that was his goal, was to make them stand out and look different than the nations around, that they would once again be God's own people. And they did walk that way for a short while. But how quickly they moved away from that. It's just amazing.
You know, it helps us understand God's commandment to utterly destroy the nations when they entered
that's
in
right.
to this land. And he said for that specific reason.
That's right. He told them what would happen.
If you don't, this is what's going to happen. I mean, there's an application to us today as well.
Sure.
You know, are we leaving vestiges of our old lives in our hearts and in the way we conduct ourselves? Or are we,
yeah.
Or are we utterly destroying them?
That's right. That's right. What is the gods of this world have to be destroyed within us, or they will influence and they will destroy us. It's the same thing. David.
Well, I see it 20 years ago, homosexuality here was not accepted that well. Mm-hmm. And since then, you can see it just slowly mm-hmm. progress, and now there's a big majority.
It's infiltrated.
I think it's fine.
Yeah, yeah. And among many of the religions in this nation, most have accepted now, you know, such things as homosexuality. We'll be pressured on that too. You know, it'll come. So going back to Nehemiah and just trying to think this through, there's some more. You know, Nehemiah brings up Solomon and it brings this into light. You know, what are some conclusions we need to draw from this incident? You know, what Nehemiah is dealing with there. I mean, what conclusions do we draw about marriage in the eyes of God? What do we have to see?
God wants us to marry somebody that's going to be a help and a support to us. Mm-hmm. Not somebody that's going to drag us down. Mm-hmm.
Someone's going to help us in a relationship with Jehovah God. Okay? Other thoughts?
One of the purposes of God choosing this people to be his people was to focus on one group of people, keep that law in history mm-hmm. to prove his son. What this shows us is that it doesn't matter whether we are good or bad, God can still get his problems mm-hmm. done. He mm-hmm. can take care of it. So whether the Israelites were good or bad, and they were both from time to time, he still accomplished what he set out to do.
Yeah.
And so
he still accomplished his will in the end result. He did.
And so he can accomplish his will even with us today.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not mm-hmm. we are the good or the bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It's amazing at times that God has used those who were opposed to him to still
yeah.
accomplish his will.
And certainly we had a period in this country, I think, that we did pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been those ups and downs. There has.
Right now, I think we're pretty well on the downside. But God,
I'm afraid,
will still get done.
That's true. That is true. You know, in the last part here of the chapter, you know, verse 29, Nehemiah says, "Remember me, O God, because they defiled the priestly office and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites." The end of the last verse, again, he says, "Remember me with favor, O God." Four times or five times, he says in the chapter. After dealing with each of these issues, he says, "Remember me, O God." You know, it makes maybe even some mention of, you know, "Show mercy to me." You know, what do you think of that? Well, what do you make of the fact that he continues to plead to God or make this request of God?
He's got a personal relationship with God that he has to keep. He knows in his heart that he has to keep that.
Yeah, yeah. What else? I just find it interesting, you know, that... Especially when he says, "Remember me for this also, my God, and show mercy to me according to your love." You know, that's maybe that's part of it. It's like, I've tried. You know, don't judge me as you may judge them. I've tried. Maybe that's a good point. Yeah, James.
Well, he knew he was dealing with an obstinate people.
probably had to hurt a lot of people to get things done the right way. And he was trying to do the right thing, stand for the right, knowing full well he was dealing with humans like himself. So it might have been a forgiveness sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yes, Lord, I've had to.
Because he really had to stand up to some issues, which, in fact, takes us into more of the application of some things. Okay, now this lesson 12, these last few pages, we've kind of worked on just going through the text of chapter 13. So let's look at our lesson 13 now, which starts making application of some of these points. And I just found a lot of points to make application to in this chapter. I mean, what we can make application to personally today, or the Lord's church today collectively. You know, Nehemiah's way of dealing with some of the issues, even as James reminds us right here, I mean, he had a very direct approach, didn't he? I mean, we've seen that all the way through the story. But when he comes back here in chapter 13, and there's all of these issues in Jerusalem, I mean, man, he's all over that. You know, dealing with it, and there's some decisions that had to be made, and there was some separating the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, that had to be done. And he was all about that. And so he had a very direct approach dealing with some of these problems. And some may have thought that Nehemiah's reaction here was a little bit over the top. But let's think about it for a minute. Godly leaders do not tolerate sin. And we've seen that with Nehemiah throughout the story. And we can think of other godly leaders as well that we would say the same thing, that we'd make the same point or application to. Some points here on our worksheet. A critical point. There must be a clear understanding of who God's people are and who are not. When Nehemiah came back into town, I can only imagine there had to be some sorting out here. Who was on the Lord's side? And who is not? And there were some judgments that Nehemiah was in the place and position of having to make some judgments. And he did. And I find that impressive that he stepped into that position, that role. It was the position God had given him. And he made some decisions. Nehemiah drew clear lines of fellowship, which made it easier to see the danger of the compromising companionships.
He requested the same thing of the Levites. When it was like kill your brother,
where Moses more or less said, choose which side you're going to be on. You know, remember that? I mean, there was some distinctions that had to be made. You know, which side are you going to be on? And I think that's more or less what we're seeing with Nehemiah here too. There had to be the sorting out of who was on the Lord's side and who was not. Because when that does not happen, how do you know? And if the influence of evil is still running around in the middle of those who are trying to do right, that influence of evil is going to be a problem. It's going to cause tremendous problems. And so Nehemiah, this is the way I kind of view this. Nehemiah drew some clear lines of fellowship here and sorted that out. And when that kind of distinction is made, you can more clearly discern, you can more clearly see and understand who's on the Lord's side and who is not. And it had to be done. How do you suppose that went over? I mean, I just can't imagine that everyone just kind of bowed down and rolled over and said, okay, Nehemiah. I mean, can't you imagine there was someone who stood up and said, but that's not the way we do it here. Can't you imagine that? There's someone that surely that stood up and said, now, you know, you just don't understand us. You know, you don't understand what we like. This is our way of serving. Can't you imagine there's someone who stood up and caused and posed some opposition? Because it's always been that way. You know, in the Bible stories as we go through it. But on the other hand, that you know, Nehemiah's response here should not be a surprise to us, because godly leaders do not tolerate sin. I mean, none of us should. But when you have someone who is put in a position, as Nehemiah was here, to do the will of God and to lead God's people, there could be no tolerance of sin. Think about that some. Les?
What if Nehemiah had not insisted on the cleansing of pagan influences?
Yeah.
You know, if you go forward in history, by the time Jesus comes, idolatry, lots of other things made him problems, but idolatry was not one of them in the nation of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They had problems with self-righteousness and adding traditions onto the law and, you know, other kinds of heart issues. But what if at this time Nehemiah had not been insistent upon them separating themselves from their pagan women,
mm-hmm.
you know, and pagan influences? You see that there was that cleansing. Verse 30 says, "Thus I cleanse them from everything pagan." You know, in other words, the seed
right.
of that pagan influence would have multiplied as opposed to being
stopped. Exactly. Good point. Powerful point. I mean, Israel would continue to have problems going forward, but they finally do come to a point where idolatrous worship is not their problem. You know, that is finally purged. I really want to think about this and think about application. I mean, I think there's some direct analogies even we can make with the Lord's church. I mean, just think about some questions here. What happens when we fail to distinguish between those who desire truth and those who are willing to compromise it? Let's put it in the realm of the church. What happens when we fail to distinguish between those who love truth and those who don't love it? They'll compromise. What happens?
Paul said, "A little leaven leavens the whole lump."
Absolutely. Yeah, it does. And the whole point of that being even just that, I mean, I really don't understand the whole thing about baking and the leaven and stuff like that. I know you have to have leaven to make certain things rise. I understand that much. But you know, the proportions of it, all I know is that it doesn't take a lot of yeast or whatever it is to make certain things rise. And that was Paul's point in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. You know, when the problem there was sin in the church. And seemingly that they were content going on that way and accepting into fellowship a brother who was openly living in sin. And really, as the text would say, they were puffed up. It seems as though they were proud of their association. And Paul writes to him and says, "Wait a minute, you can't do this." And his reason for that is not only is that brother's soul going to be lost, but yours may be lost too, because a little leaven leavens the whole lump, is what he says. And so we start thinking about and making applications that's real to us today type applications, or applications to the church. If we fail to distinguish between those who truly want to know and live by God's truth and those who are willing to compromise it, if we're not willing to say, "No, wait a minute, now, I can't agree with what you said because it's not what the book says." If we're unwilling to do that, all will be compromised in time. And when people say, no, that's not going to happen, wait a minute. You and I are not having an argument. Take your argument to God. Let me know how that works out for you. Because it's what God said. When we start arguing these kind of points with God, think about what we are doing. God says that we cannot mix truth and compromise it at the same time. Or mix soundness with those who do not love truth. We can't do that. God said so. And so, again, thinking about Nehemiah. And just the process of what happened in Jerusalem when he came back, he came back and he separated the chaff from the wheat. You know, those who did not love truth and those who would stand for truth. He did it in a pretty decisive way from what we can see in the text. And I'm telling you, sometimes in the church that has to be done too. Other thoughts, examples, comments? Absolutely. Easily let off because they don't have the foundation of truth. And that so often, if there is one who comes into a church that has in his heart the desire to lead off some, I mean, where does he go? Goes to the babes. Sorts out those who, even if they've got some age to him and have been a Christian for a while, goes to those that he discerns do not have a knowledge base because they can be pulled off. The danger, we can see the danger. Exactly.
It's also reminding me of the lesson my dad taught back in May about all the consequences of Jehoshaphat when he allied with Ahab.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to make peace with evil.
Mm-hmm.
And
never works. That's right. Yeah. Compromised is what he did. Other thoughts? Gene?
We see that all the time under the guise of loving the sinner, and if you love the sinner, then you have to accept the sinner, and all of a sudden you're accepting what the sinner is believing.
Mm.
It's a growing thing that happens. You've got to draw the line. Yes, we love the sinner, but we hate the sin.
Mm-hmm.
And
if the sinner is going to stay in sin, then we're going to have to say, there's going to be some lines of fellowship that's drawn here. And that's what Nehemiah did too. Interesting thoughts. He was uncompromising in that faith with God. You're right. And taking that type of a position, of course, it didn't set him back in any way with his relationship with God. It could only make it stronger. That's a good point. When we make choices that are those hard choices of faith sometime, and where we have to separate from those who do not love truth, that's not going to hurt our relationship with God. It's going to endear our relationship with God. It's going to draw us closer to God when we have to make those choices. Yeah, interesting point. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul is warning the church in Thessalonica that there are certainly some who are going to come along that are going to leave the Lord, going to leave the faith, so to speak. And there are going to be those who come and try to deceive you is really what he's trying to deal with. It's a warning that he's given to these brethren. And just reading a little bit of this warning, the latter part of chapter 2, or middle part here, beginning around, let's go to verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all deception of unrighteousness in those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all might be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And he's saying, brethren, don't be fooled that way. But you know, understand the undertow that Satan sends in such a way that he can lie and deceive and fool people. And if you do not have a distinct love for the truth, you will be pulled in by that. And he will take you under, because that's what Satan does. That's the warning that he's giving right here. Don't be deceived. It's a strong delusion that Satan sends, that they should believe the lie. You know, Jesus calls Satan a liar and the father of lies, I believe it is in John 8, verse 44. It's what he does. He works to deceive us. And so easily, you know, we are pulled in. I mean, Nehemiah had things in order in Jerusalem. He was gone just 2 years. And look what happened by the time he came back. Satan was very busy in that work.
It makes you see that we do not need to have our faith in man.
Yeah.
If you look at when Nehemiah was around, the faith was strong.
Mm-hmm.
When Nehemiah left,
mm-hmm.
the faith became weak.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happened with Moses.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet they took those things that they'd seen them worship. Just think about what Ken's question was. What made them do that? What made them worship idols? They'd seen idols and all these other things.
Sure.
They had seen.
And they didn't destroy them all.
No. And they saw how they played up to them.
Mm-hmm.
Huge idols like Diana and others that were later we read about in Ephesians. And those were great scenes. Looked at them and they thought, wow, that's great. You know, I can see that God. That's what happens to people today. We look to see the influence of man or the world, and we tend to concentrate on that instead of what God wants us to do is look at him. You know, he didn't bring a king up that had great, was dressed in great clothing and marched around town with big cars and guards and everything going around. Look at my new child that's going to be the king one day. He didn't do that. That's what the world was. He brought a mild, meek, quiet, and a manger.
Mm-hmm.
And he became king. And that's the type of people that God wants.
Mm-hmm.
Those meek and mild people, not those that are pompous and proud and want to be seen.
The emphasis being that of an attitude of the heart and a love for truth. The Christians that the Apostle Peter was writing to in 1 Peter chapter 1, he was complimenting them, really, you know, for what their faith had done. Just quickly, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 22, seeing that you have purified your souls in obeying the truth of the Spirit in unfeigned love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart, having been born again, not of corruptible seed, but incorruptible through the word of God, which lives and abides forever. A lot of points you could make from the passage. But we understand the love of truth that is necessary. That's what we're going to have to overcome all the influences that is around us for us to stand right before God purified, having our souls purified, is going to have to come from a heart that is set on obeying the truth. And that's where we have to set our heart. There's some more we can say about this, and what I'm thinking here for Lord willing, for Wednesday night, there's some more points on this part I want us to make. I want us to think about here some more. We're on the upper part of page 25, maybe like where it says, what should our response be? I want to talk about that some more. And again, we're making application to us today. And I don't know, I thought we would finish that up on Wednesday night, this lesson. We're going to aim that way. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. And then we're getting ready to go into John.